for Friday, a beautiful peak of spring. Let's open up public hearing on House Bill 3622A. Mr. Russell, Mr. Landauer, and Don Schellenberg are listed on that. So let's get the three of you up here and see why we need this puppy.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Russell with the Oregon Trucking Associations, and I'll just go through the whole thing with you.
Thank
you. That's okay. Last session, we passed House Bill 2936, which was we referred to as our buddy bill, and it had a reduction in registration fees for Volkswagen campers. It had an increase in fines for trucking companies that failed to hire pilot cars when they were required. And it had the what we called the Move It legislation that required people that were involved in fender benders to move the vehicles off to the side of the road so they didn't impede rush hour traffic. Those were the three pieces that were in that bill. The piece dealing with the Volkswagen camper was perfectly fine, and that's done. The other two pieces in the bill had errors in them, which were fixing with 3622. While we were over in the House, we picked up another buddy, Mr. Schellenberg, and we added him to 3622. So let me explain to you what it does. The original 2936A increased the penalties for all violations of a size and weight permit from $97 to $427. That was not our intent. Our intent was only to deal with those violations where there was an economic incentive to violate because the fine was too low, and that was the pilot cars.
Mm-hmm.
So we've made this bill now very specific that it deals with pilot cars, but we also agreed with the department that there's one other instance where there's that economic incentive, and that's when a trucker does not stay on the prescribed route when they're hauling an oversized load.
Mm-hmm.
So we added that one to this also. So now we've increased the penalties from 97 to 427 just for the two instances that we intended, failure to hire pilot cars and failure to stay on the prescribed route. And the problem we had with the Move It legislation, and we copied that straight from South Carolina, basically what it said is that the driver of the vehicles were not injured, then you move it to the side of the road. Law enforcement pointed out to us that the driver may not be injured, but a passenger could be injured, a pedestrian, a bicyclist, or whatever, and they do not want the vehicles moved to the side of the road. So what this does is it clarifies that and says that if anyone is injured, you don't move it. If nobody's injured, you do move it. And then the third piece that we added at the request of the Farm Bureau over in the House, right now, the information in the application for a farm license plate that goes on a farm truck is prescribed in statute, and it requires that the farmer identify the township, which you folks know is part of the legal description of the property. Often the farmer doesn't know the township, so they leave it blank. So ODOT rejects the application because it's a statutory requirement. So what this does is it eliminates the requirement to identify the township in an application for a farm license plate. Those are the three provisions. The Oregon Trucking Association supports all three, and we have other gentlemen here that certainly support the portions that they have the greatest interest in. That concludes my testimony. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, well, let's go to Mr. Schellenberg and have him explain to us why his farmers don't know where they live.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Don Schellenberg representing... I don't even know my name.
You don't know the name, I. We're off to a rocky start here.
Representing the Oregon Farm Bureau. It's not that they don't know where they live. It's just an issue that they don't ever use that for anything. And in consultation with the Motor Carrier Division, they said, we don't even need that information. So, they indicated if you get a chance, get rid of it. So I found the chance, and we appreciate your support in that effort. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Mr. Landauer?
Mark Landauer with the City of Portland's Office of Government Relations.
Mr. Move It Off the Highway himself.
Yes. Mr. Russell has described the provisions in Section 3 perfectly adequately. I don't, frankly, have anything to add unless you have any questions.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. I'm familiar with those issues that some of our committee members are, others may not be. Are there any questions of the committee or concerns? Do we need more detail about any of this? Well, you know, started a little rocky, got rather smooth. Is there anybody else that wants to testify on 3622? Okay. Close public hearing, open a work session on House Bill 3622. Senator Johnson?
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 3622 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay, Senator Johnson has moved House Bill 3622 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Any other discussion? Any objection? So ordered, I'll carry back. Okay, now we don't have anybody here for 3623? Do we have anybody here for 3623? So some people are just maybe using the room to rest. And is Mr. Tyndall?
He's out in the hall.
Well, let's get him in here. It's Friday. We're not wasting time on a Friday.
Bicycle thing.
You're a great American, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman, just a question. Do we have this third provision anywhere that comes from Mr. Schellenberg?
It should. It's in the A. Engross bill.
It's in the A. Engross bill.
Yes, it was. It was an amendment that was introduced and adopted by the House committee.
House. Okay. All right.
Okay, we'll open up the informational hearing on House on Senate Bill 566. Mr. Tyndall, back for an encore. And thank you for your patience yesterday and allowing us to have a little bit more opportunity to hear from you today.
Chair Metzger, members of the committee, good afternoon. Doug Tyndall, Deputy Director, Oregon Department of Transportation. Senator, not a problem at all. I thought yesterday's discussion was very in-depth and enlightening and certainly portrays all of the complexities of the issues around transportation funding, so not a problem to be back today at all. I'm going to talk about I appreciate the opportunity to be able to talk about Senate Bill 566. Senate Bill 566 passed, I think, originated in this committee in the 2007 session, and really gave us some good guidance, and it gave us a good opportunity in one sense, and I'll talk about that a little bit as I go through the bill. There were three aspects to the bill. Talking about how ODOT deals with its real property, talking about the projects that are needed on the state highway system, and talking about the projects of statewide significance. And I'll address these in that order and answer any questions as I go along, recognizing I probably didn't need to say that to this committee, but nevertheless, I will answer them as I go along. So on real property management, this is something that the Oregon Transportation Commission had already talked to us about, and I think actually built on the direction of the Transportation Commission in terms of making sure that ODOT understood where the property was, where we owned property, and where we had opportunity to make that property available for sale. And so we had started on, and with the guidance from this committee, are continuing on in a second phase that I'll talk about, a right-of-way management system that indeed identifies all of our various pieces of property that have been purchased throughout the development of the highway system over the time that ODOT has existed. And we didn't have that in electronic form before. It was all in paper maps, all very difficult to find. And this effort is allowing us to put that into electronic format and identify properties that we can sell, which has a couple of benefits. One, some of our pieces of property, remnants of property around projects that we had done where we had bought property that was greater than what we needed to eventually build the project, are in desirable locations for businesses. And so businesses want to put them there. And, of course, the second benefit to that is it puts the property back on the tax rolls for the local governments. The concept behind this whole strategy, it's really a two-biennium strategy, started in 05 and 07, and now with the guidance from this committee, continuing in 07, 09, was to raise $9 million, which actually covers more than the cost of the system. I think the total cost over the two-biennia was around just over $4 million. And already, through the benefits of the system that we've got in place, in the first quarter, we've sold 62% of that goal already. So we are selling surplus property at a far greater rate than we've sold property in the past.
Senator Johnson has a question.
Mr. Tindall, is it okay that we interrupt with questions?
Please.
Mr. Tindall and I had a pretty lively conversation not all that long ago about the methodology for disposing of this property, and one of the things that I'd like you to comment on, I had a constituent who had a little odd-shaped piece of property immediately adjacent to his property. I read in the report that you have made this surplus property inventory available to the public for a long time, but I'm not sure the public knows that it's there. To make a long story short, the piece of property came up for auction. My guy desperately wanted to buy it. It ended up being purchased by someone who appears to be speculating. As soon as this third party bought it, offered it back to the adjacent property owner at a much inflated rate. Now, I know the market sometimes is a cruel place, but what I was talking to Doug about was, is there any a courtesy accommodation that you would make to an adjacent property owner that particularly these little oddball pieces were going to come up? And rather than just casting the adjacent property into the uncharted seas of the great public, was there a chance for the adjacent property owner to at least be notified so that they could participate? And I felt badly for the constituent who contacted me because he ended up buying the piece of property immediately adjoining his for three times the price in order to secure and protect his business interests from perhaps an incompatible application. And Doug, you said you thought that was a good idea at the time. I just wanted to get some idea from you if anything has been institutionalized to try to accommodate, out of respect, the adjacent property owners.
Chair Metzger, Senator Johnson, yeah, a couple of things. One, as it turned out, we did have a normal practice of notifying adjacent property owners. The problem in this particular situation there was apparently a public way that went between your constituent's property and this remnant of property, and it's really not a material public way, but it didn't show up to us as being adjacent. So that was the first thing. In our normal practice, do ensure that we notify adjacent property owners. But the second thing that we did take that is new in response to that situation, so that we make sure that it doesn't have to be exactly precisely adjacent. We are now putting up for sale signs anywhere where we offer property, so that anybody that drives by is aware of it. I think in the case that what happened in the case that you cited, the original purchaser from us found out that it was for sale, and there was otherwise no other public notice that it was for sale, or very little public notice that it was for sale. And so we think by putting the sign out there, that will solve the problem. The second thing is,
May I just follow up, Mr. Sure. Chair? So you would decide to dispose of another piece of property, and I don't know whether or not ODOT still has to go through the process of making it available to other state agencies.
Yes, they do.
And so you make the decision you're going to sell it. You go through the requisite notice to other state agencies. Then the for sale sign goes up for some period of time once you have a clear path to its sale, so that there would be ample time for somebody to come out and see right next to their eating establishment, yes, in fact, ODOT intends to sell this piece, so that they could make application.
And Senator Metzger, Senator Johnson, that's correct. The other thing I wanted to clear up is while we have been making surplus property information available, we haven't done it in an electronic form, and that's what's really the next step here, so that not only would a property owner in that situation be notified and clearly notified and have that opportunity, but in fact they would have been able to go onto the internet probably and see that there was a piece of property there that was owned by ODOT and come to us if they had an interest in that property. So that's really what the second step of this
is. So they could follow up, Mr. Chair. They could actually make a proactive offer prior to your decision to list it, so that you would have knowledge that they were highly desirous of pursuing the sale?
Chair Metzger, Senator Johnson, yes, that is not all that uncommon, where someone is aware that we have a piece of property and they'll come and say, hey, can we do surplus this piece of property, and we'll go through the process of surplusing it.
Thank you very much. I take considerable comfort in that, because at the end of the day, my constituent ended up paying dearly to get back something that would have been detrimental to his business establishment had it gone to someone else. And I just don't want to make a market in surplus ODOT property where there's a secondary market trying to protect the adjacent business owners.
And Chair Metzger, let me assure Senator Johnson and the committee, that is not our intention at all. And that's why we're trying to use the new system to be as open as possible and make as much information as possible out there so that everybody's aware and not just certain people are aware.
Senator Berger had a question.
Oh, sorry.
Yes. Doug, just to clarify a little bit, because I'm not real sure that that gives the protection that maybe someone would want. In other words, you have a piece of property, and you put a sign on it, it's for sale, but the first guy there buys the property. The owner next door doesn't have first right of refusal. So I think, you know, I would take comfort in first right of refusal.
Chair Metzger, Senator Verger, I'm not sure. I think we're getting into real estate law, which, and I'm not a lawyer to start with, and it's certainly not a real estate lawyer. So I don't know what the issues are around that in terms of being able to allow them to have first right of refusal. But I will check into that and get back to you to see if that's possible to do.
Okay. Senator Verger.
Thank you, Mr. Doug, I know that just kind of through anecdotally, there's a lot of little minuscule pieces of property that that are around the state in rural areas which have almost no value. And to go through any kind of process to liquidate those seems like there wouldn't be, you guys would actually be going backwards as far as expending dollars. How do you guys make that determination? Where's the point, breakover point? Because I can think of several pieces of property that I know of that if you actually spent any time at all to drive out and put a sign on it, you probably went backwards on selling that property.
Chair Metzger, Senator George, what we do is, first off, we need to understand that we own those pieces of property. Those are times, to speak to your question, Senator Verger, where if the property is in a spot that's unusable to anybody except the adjacent owner, we'll make the offer to the adjacent owner, and we would not put up a sign in that case because there's no other access to it. And so overstated that our effort to make things public in those kinds of cases. It's a small, de minimis piece of property that can't be reached by anyone else. We wouldn't go through that process. We would contact the adjoining landowner to see if they had interest in buying it. So the net of all that is that we've greatly improved our ability to manage our right-of-way and to obtain the greatest value from our right-of-way and make sure that we don't have and put property back on the roll on property rolls so that we don't have property just sitting around when it could be in use for business and for public taxes.
Okay, what I'm going to do is I have a question for you, and then I think we're wrapping up that first section. And I'm going to go to Representative Kremel-Wise here, and then we'll come back to Section 2.
Okay.
But on the Section 1 here, because one of the things I'm concerned about, and the reason this was in 566, is not just sale of, quote, surplus property or the department's assessment that this is surplus property, because someone else may, some outside third-party source may have recommendations that think something is surplus or should be surplus that you don't. That's the one part of this. The second part of it is, as per our discussion last year, was it's not just necessarily the sale of property, but having a set of independent eyes, in addition to your own, who might have some ideas of how you might maximize some of the property you do have that you don't otherwise think is available. And I use the example in 07 with some of our very large bridges with lots and lots of property under them that possibly could be leased for office space or parking garages or whatever, but maybe your staff would never think about that or think that that's, quote, a value. And our discussion was, and I believe in the process of passing the bill, part of the fiscal that was your desire to hire an outside consultant who would provide you some other opportunities to maximize revenue. And I want to know where we are with that.
Okay. Senator Metzger, thank you for reminding me of that portion, the leasing portion. I think there's a statistic in here that says that our property sales were $4.24 million. Our lease revenue was $1.33 million. And we, understanding where you wanted to head with this, and I had not talked about this, I think that issue is answered in two ways. First, by making more public, more easily available, the property that we own. We foster that sort of possibility of someone coming to us and saying, hey, we think we can do something on your property, whether it's a lease or a purchase. That in combination with the public-private partnership legislation that was passed in 2003 that really enables those kinds of discussions to go on. So you've got to know where the property is, and then you've got to have an interested person, and I think those two pieces are there. We have not hired a consultant yet to look at our property. We're focused on identifying where all of our property is. But that hasn't stopped us from, as this indicates, leasing some property. And in fact, under I-405, there is some extensive parking areas that are leased parking areas that are right away, just along exactly the lines that you're talking about. So we're focused on making sure we know where the property is and then getting that word out to those entrepreneurial minds that can come in and look at us and look at our property and say, hey, we have an opportunity here. We can together make some money for the state or make some money and stimulate economic development.
Well, I appreciate that, Mr. Till, because and I would implore you to be very proactive about that, because there's one thing to have the stuff online for people to see it, but going back to Senator Johnson's point earlier about just because it's online, it doesn't necessarily reach out to everyone who might be aware of the fact or would like to be aware of the fact that you would really like to entertain some creative thoughts about how that might be done. And there's that leap of communication between stuff being available and saying, here, come give us some great ideas about how we might maximize our asset.
Right. Senator Johnson.
You said one other thing, Mr. Tindall, that kind of intrigued me, apropos a conversation that you and I had in a hearing not all that long ago, about you're focused right now on identifying where all your property is. Do you guys know where all your property is?
Chair Metzger, Senator Johnson, that's probably a misstatement. We know where it is. We in all sorts of just literally rooms full of maps. We know where it is, and we have surveys and deeds. We don't have that in a form that you can easily go back and say, in a one-mile radius around this point, what all properties do you have? But we know we have all of the appropriate legal documentation to know where our properties are.
Because it appeared from our last exchange on this issue that 22 acres and sisters had briefly gone missing.
Chair Metzger, Senator Johnson, we knew about that. It had never gone missing. And I'm going to be in front of the Ways and Means Committee on Monday to explain that. But what Senator Johnson's talking about is a request that we had made regarding a maintenance station and sisters. And subsequent to making that request, I'm not sure exactly where this came from, but we did know about this. We have a quarry site not very far from Sisters, and so the question was, why didn't ODOT mention this during the hearing on the Sisters maintenance station? The answer to that question is that we haven't decided where we're going yet. That is one possibility of a place to go. There are other possibilities. I think I didn't do a very good job in that discussion and in answering your question, Senator Johnson, to make clear that what we were asking for was some authority so that we knew we had expenditure authority, but we were willing to have that money unscheduled until we decided where we were going to go. And I didn't, that was my fault. I did not make that clear. And I will have the opportunity to make that crystal clear on Monday, and I look forward for the opportunity to do so.
I'm anxious for Monday to get there.
Okay, thank you. I'll just ask you to step aside just for a brief moment. We'll close recess the informational hearing and open public hearing on 3623. And Representative Crummell, if you want to come forward, we'll get you on your way.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, State Representative Jerry Crummell, House District 26, Wilsonville, Sherwood, and over to Gaston. Most of you might be familiar with this bill, although it didn't make it to the Senate before as House Bill 3020 in a previous life. I like to call this bill Eric's
Thank
Law,
you.
Named after Eric Kowski, who, as a good friend of mine, was killed in June of 2005 when a car, the driver was tired, overtired, and Eric was on his bike wearing a helmet, traveling in the bike lane on 12th and Sherwood Road, and he was run over and killed. Shortly after, and I've known Eric a long time, and I'll get into that in a minute, but shortly after his death, his widow, Lorna, and I would apologize for her not being able to be here today, but she's at a family funeral in California, we've worked for the last 3 years to try to get this passed. But she asked me after his death to see if we could look into legislation so that other families that wanted to be able to have some kind of a memorial to their loved one that was killed and that it was a criminal act would be able to have such. And the state has does have another program for drunk drivers. You've probably seen them on the road. It says don't drink and drive, and then there will be the name of somebody underneath them. So what we did was we approached, in 2005, we approached Washington County and asked them if they were willing to do this for cyclists and pedestrians who were killed and a criminal conviction was involved. The county was reluctant at first because there wasn't something in state statute. And so we said, you know, we can address that later during the legislative session. But we did. So one of the things that this bill will do is it's going to give language that cities and counties can use also in their own ordinances, so that if they get a request, they've got a basis in state law for being able to honor the request. So the county was reluctant, but we did work with Washington County on the formation of their rules, and we've actually taken that model, and that's what we've put into House Bill 3623. I'd like to talk about Eric for a minute. Eric and I go way back to the early 1980s, and both of us are athletic trainers, and we created the state organization of Oregon Athletic Trainers Society, and Eric was one of the founders of that organization and was the president after I was. I was the founding president, and he became president from 87 to 91. He has been a lifelong educator, and he taught biology at Tigard High School and was their athletic trainer for about 26 years, and then he retired. And then it was a year after that that he was, not quite a year after his retirement, that he was killed. So what 3623 does is it establishes state guidelines, which, as I mentioned, can be used at the local level as well. It seems like this is one way to keep people aware that we do need to share the roads. Since last summer, I don't think a day has gone by that we haven't heard about somebody somewhere getting run over, either as a pedestrian or as a cyclist. One thing I'd just like to mention is that there's a couple of developments that have kind of added to this. On January 1st, a new law took effect that requires motorists to keep a safe distance from cyclists that are on the side of the road. A new share of the road license plate is now available from DMV that helps raise money for bicycle safety programs. And the city of Portland is now adding colorful bike boxes to 15 of their intersections, which will offer bicyclists a sort of a buffer zone separate from cars. Portland, of course, as you well know, has a national reputation for being bicycle friendly, and especially for commuters. But there's also been an increase in death and injuries. Over the past decade, nearly 380 people have died, and about 2,600 were injured on the Portland streets. 40% were either bicyclists or pedestrians. The number of annual deaths since the 1990s has doubled. Basic components of the bill. The family would request and pay a fee for the sign, and it would be up to the agency to decide how much to charge. In Washington County, the fee was $300, and that included the making of the sign and the installation. They would say, we've seen them, and here is a sort of a... this is the one that was placed by Washington County for Eric Kautsky, and it just says "Share the Road" at the top, and it has a picture of a bicyclist and a car, and then at the bottom it says "In memory of Eric Kautsky." So there is no fiscal on this, because the agency can determine how much on a per sign basis that they would need to charge. There needs to be a conviction in order to qualify for a sign, a conviction of wrongful driving, vehicular homicide, those types of things. And then the sign needs to be requested within 18 months and can only stay up for 3 years. And early on in 05 or 07, excuse me, we had testimony from ODOT that said a sign typically stays up for about 7 years, but we thought 3 years was a good realm, because that allows to honor the deceased person and also remind people to share the road. And it doesn't make it overbearing on the department to be able to maintain the signs, because there's not anything that they, within 3 years, if it's starting to become dilapidated or anything, it's going to come down anyway. The only thing that would need to be done, if somebody took a screw out or something and it fell down. But it's basically two purposes, is to give a way for grieving families to remember their loved ones, and in a kind of public way. And not everybody wants to do that, but there are some people that do. And then the other purpose is to remind people that we do need to share the road, that we do have other users out there besides cars, and that it's important that we recognize that they're there. And sometimes just that little reminder is a good idea. And it does let somebody know that there's been another fatality. I think I'm hopeful that this will send a message that whoever's driving by, and a reminder to be aware of their surroundings and to look for to other users. I think that one of the things that's interesting about this is that Eric, I mentioned earlier, was an educator, and even in death he's continuing to educate. And the reason is because of that sign sitting up there on Twalton Sherwood Road that says "Share the Road," and it has his name on it. With that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to take any questions. One other thing is that I just do want to mention that this passed out of the House 57-0 on the vote. It was very, very much supported, and I also want to thank Representative Reed for kind of reviving it in this annual session experiment. And I also, since Eric was a constituent, and his widow is still a constituent, Senator George's, if you do pass this out, I certainly wouldn't object to seeing Senator George carry it on the floor, but maybe he would object to doing it. I don't know. I haven't asked him that. And the other thing that I would point out is that we do have a -1 amendment that would just says that this law would be known as Eric's Law. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'll answer any questions.
Thank you, Representative Crummell. Senator Johnson.
Thank you. I want to make sure that I understood you, Representative Crummell. Is the sign up now?
Yes.
Then why is this law necessary? Would Washington County come and take the sign down if this bill doesn't pass?
I don't know that, Mr. Chair and Senator Johnson, I don't know that Washington County will go take it down, but the one thing that Washington County was concerned about was the fact that there was not an allowance in state law for this type of sign. And Kathy Latola from Washington County was concerned about that, but she said, well, maybe if we create a rule that, and we kind of, and so she tried to make it fairly tight as to how this could be applied, and that's what we took and brought into state law. But by having it into state law, local governments, when they're faced with this, are going to feel, because it's in the statute, are going to feel a lot more at ease about passing their own ordinances or passing their own rules to be able to place them.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. This applies. I'm very sympathetic with the goal of this bill. We had a hearing in this very room the other day that was ostensibly to give public voice to the anguish of a family that had lost a loved one in a traffic accident. But my concern is, particularly looking at the City of Portland's representatives in the back of the room, this applies to state highways. Are we going to end up with sort of two classes of memorials? I don't know where the city is about having a proliferation of signs marking spots where urban bicyclists were killed. And I just wonder, does this lead to a proliferation of signs in municipalities? I know this speaks specifically to state law, but why is one set of grieving families honored with a sign for their loved one, and perhaps municipalities would resist the idea of having signage inside the urban confines for the loved ones of that were killed inside an urban area?
Mr. Chair and Senator Johnson, I think that's a very good question. The thing about this is that there's nothing in here that requires local government to do something with it. There's nothing in here that says local governments have to put up a sign. So it would be, so for example, with the City of Portland, it would be their choice. If a family came forward and asked the City of Portland Department of Transportation to put a sign up, state law is there allowing it, but the City of Portland could certainly say yes or no.
This says on state highways, though.
This is,
that's not downtown Portland.
That's correct. So it's up to the local government to make the decision. On state highways, a family could call ODOT and say, yeah, we'd like to put a sign up, and we'd like to make the application. Here's all of the information, and then ODOT would make a determination from their rules whether or not this is something that whether it meets the criteria, and if it does, then put it up. But it gives local government the color of state law to have a basis for being able to grant the signs if they wanted to be able to do it.
Any other questions? Senator Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Crummell, I'm very sympathetic with people who lose loved ones in such a tragic way that there's a lot of side effects to those kinds of deaths. But I guess that another thing is that we actually encourage bicyclists. I mean, we're producing bike lanes all along 101, so that's saying come and ride your bike. It's not like we're trying to discourage people. On the other hand, would you be supportive of the registration of bicycles so that people who are using the roads and are putting themselves at risk at the same time are helping fund some of the activity of riding bicycles on our state highway?
Mr. Chair and Senator Berger, is that a trick question? No, I'm just kidding. I'm just kidding. I think that it certainly is something that the legislature might want to look at. I know that we face this. You and I both face this in local government as we were rebuild streets or renovate streets. And if you decide you're going to put widen streets, and if you decide you're going to put a bike lane in, you end up building a bike lane to the same standard that you have built the regular street at. Which, of course, for a combined weight of say 220 pounds, the bike 20 pounds, and the rider 200 or whatever, versus the combined weight of 4,500 pounds for a car. You don't need the same thickness of concrete and that sort of thing. There's also been some questions coming up in some of the research about whether or not bike lanes really are as safe as we would like to believe that they are. But with all of that said, if it is something that can be used to help make things safer for bicyclists than and if a registration fee became necessary, and it's also based on helping find stolen bikes, kind of like car licenses are and that sort of thing, I maybe would be supportive of that. Yeah.
Okay. Great. Representative Crummell, how wedded are you to the Dash 1 amendments?
Well, let's put it this way: if it would kill the bill, then I'm not. Then I don't think that the Dash 1s have to be put in. I would like to see them put in because I would like to see this known as Eric's Law, because that's the genesis of the bill. But at the same time, if it's something that kills the bill, then kill the amendment.
I just would like to at least voice on the record my concern about starting to name laws after people. There seems to be a sort of national infatuation with doing that, and maybe the first couple were interesting, but when we've got Gladys's Law and Fred's Law, and I think the runaway proliferation, at least to me, is not an attractive thing. It ought to be a law applicable to all. I mean, I understand the application piece of it. I just don't like the idea of naming laws after people. It just isn't unappealing to me, and I at least wanted to let you know of that concern.
Okay.
Appreciate that.
Thank you. Thank you, Rex. I'll let you get back to your work. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 3623, and I'm going to bring Mr. Teetle back up. Continue with 566. Thank you for coming, Representative.
Thank you. Thanks, Chairman.
Thank you for your
committee.
Doug
Tindall again. No problem. So I'll move on to the second part of the bill, the identification of projects, and Senator and members of the committee. I think this was the not that the rest of the bill wasn't critical, but this is a real key portion of this bill. This gave us the opportunity that to do something we hadn't done before, and that was go out to the area commissions on transportation and not ask them only to identify projects to go into the next statewide transportation improvement program, but to identify other projects that were necessary. And we, as we laid this out, the area commissions on transportation, let me talk about those for a minute, are around the state. They're made up of regional interest parties, elected officials, freight representation, business representation. They've been, we believe, very successful entities to help guide the project selection in the department, guide and prioritize, and make recommendations about special funding opportunities and programs. So when we did in Senate Bill 566, we were at the start or near the start of another statewide transportation improvement program cycle. And so we asked the area commissions, rather than just do the statewide transportation improvement program, identify other projects that are out there and kind of couch those in some priority order. This committee had discussions yesterday when we talked about transportation funding and the critical understanding the critical thing that constituents need to understand about what are they going to buy. And so this will help us know and have a good, solid public discussion on a number of projects that could be included if new transportation funding were available. So the area commissions are still in the process of identifying those projects. And we did one other thing that we don't do in the statewide transportation improvement program process, the STIP process. We asked the ACTS to look at kind of the traditional projects, but we asked them to also look at large projects that are over $100 million, as kind of a separate category. What we were concerned about and what we've seen happen to some extent in other STIP discussions is that those projects are so big that people just sort of say, well, we're never going to get to those, and so you don't get them on the table and you don't get the opportunity to have a discussion about those projects. So we asked them to do two things. We asked them to come up with a list, there could be, likely would be, some overlap, I think, with phases of projects, and then an identification of the large projects. And we'll be ready to report that back to the committee in July. It's I believe that is a list that will be a living list. Projects that are important at one particular time can become less important, become more important, or other projects can occur. And so I think that I really like the timing of the bill to have the area commissions complete their process, have that list available in July for you and for the public to be able to comment on and have further consideration on as we try and make sure that when we do make transportation investments, it is crystal clear what people are buying with their transportation dollars. So this is, I think, not something that we have done before, and quite frankly, I believe something we probably wouldn't have done without the guidance in Senate Bill 566, and I think it's positioned us, put us in a much better position to talk about new revenues and to talk about the specific projects that would be done as we move into the 2009 session.
Okay, before we go down to item three, which is the statewide significance one, I want to take any questions on section two, and I'll just begin by saying I think that is very critical. I know, and I traveled the state last fall on transportation. Part of the conversation that I had with folks was, as we build for a plan for the 2009 legislature, and I think each one of us in one form or another, including this committee, have reiterated that comment, and that it's going to be very, very important that the citizens around the state and those who represent them have an understanding, a clear understanding of how those dollars, especially those formula dollars, you know, which is going to be half of whatever this is, how are those going to be spent in their own community, and make sure that those are the things that not only meet the requirements of the bill, but meet the priorities of the citizens in that community, so that they know that by supporting this, that or rejecting it, that these are going to be the impacts locally. This is what it does for my community, and if they have worked well with the community, these are things the community members would support. I think that is a very, very critical part of this, and I appreciate the work that's been done, and having that in July I think is going to be very, very important, because we're going to be at a real critical time in designing this package at that, and be able to have Senator George, Senator Johnson, Senator Virgin, myself, anyone else, be able to talk about to our constituents what this will mean in transportation that's really close to home. I think that's an important part. Questions on this phase? Senator Johnson.
Thank you. I'm glad that you gave an explanation of the acts in here, because I'm not sure that everybody knows what they are. I happen to have a very high-functioning act in my district run by an extremely competent woman. My only question is, do all of the acts have participation from local elected folks on them? I know ours does, where there are representatives of municipalities as well as a county commissioner who sits in frequently. Is that the norm or is that the exception?
Chair Metzger, Senator Johnson, that's the norm.
Good. The only reason I mention this is that in discussions about the rural and regional investment boards that have taken place inside the context of Oregon Economic and Community Development's budget, I think some angst has been raised about the degree of participation from local elected folks. And when these rural investment boards are making investment decisions, which in effect demonstrate priorities, I mean, budgets are about priorities, I think there was some consternation on the part of local elected folks that they weren't adequately included. I share Senator Metzger's opinion that the work under this bill produced by the acts is going to be extraordinarily important in informing our list for consideration in 2009, and I just wanted the assurance on the record that local government was fully participatory and that there weren't any surprises or, you know, oh my God moments later when a project showed up that surprised county commissioners, for example.
Chair Johnson, or Chair Metzger, Senator Johnson, I think we're covered there.
Cool. That's great. Thank you.
Okay, Senator Berger.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to say that the acts in my area are extremely active, as you well know, Dirk, and have been there. They also are very transparent and do an excellent job of communicating to the community. And so through the years, they've built up tremendous respect by the community. So when they start prioritizing, because of the people that serve on them and who they are, the public is very likely to accept that. But this is a critical piece within this bill.
And Chair Metzger, Representative Verger, just let me add that my appreciation from and on behalf of the department and personally for the hours that those people on those area commissions spend. Mm-hmm. I can tell you that they, all of the ones that I'm familiar with, those people take that very, very seriously.
Absolutely.
And spend a lot of time, and those are not paid positions that for them to participate in the area commissions. And so I appreciate your comments and wanted to tell you that we appreciate it from a department standpoint as well.
Okay. All right. Item three.
The third item asked us to look at the projects of statewide significance. Specifically in the bill, the question was which ones could be begin construction during the next two biennia. We took the liberty of expanding that charge just a little bit to talk about, and in the analysis that's going on right now from the ODOT staff is trying to look at not only the entire project in its entirety, but also a phase of a project that might be able to begin in the next two biennia. On the projects of statewide significance, which are listed for you, I'm not going to read them all. Pioneer Mountain Eddyville is underway. Works is suspended right now. We know what the solution is. We are negotiating with the contractor around the cost of implementing that solution.
Well, since you brought that one up, and this committee had a very good tour of that in the mud early last fall.
It's green now.
And it's green now. That's a good thing. I drove through there a couple weeks ago, but it was snow, and I couldn't tell. So
it was white.
But tell me, because that. Your comment about we knew what the solution is and we're trying to figure out the cost was the same thing we heard in October.
Right.
And so what has changed since then? I mean, it sounds like we haven't made any progress on that.
I'm sorry, Chair Metzger. What's changed, we had an idea when you were there in the fall. We had an idea about a potential way to fix this. And in general, the concept was sound, but when we actually started to design it and to engineer it, we found out a couple of things that we needed to change in some technical details around geotechnical engineering. What has happened since then is we have reached agreement with the contractor, formalized the agreement with the contractor on where we are today. We have reached agreement with the contractor on how we're going to move forward in terms of who's responsible for costs, whether it's contractor or state responsibility for the additional costs. And we have moved forward to acquire a little bit more right-of-way and have not yet, I don't know that we've actually closed the right-of-way, we're very close, and have not quite finished the permitting process that's going to be necessary to implement that solution. So if I sounded like we haven't made any progress, that's really incorrect. The work has continued nonstop, effectively, to get us to a point where we are still hoping to get back to work this summer. We couldn't have done, even had we had the engineering solved and all the permits in place, we wouldn't be out there working today because the soil is too wet. So we're not losing any more time. We just need to tie up those loose ends, and we are still anticipating getting back to work this May or June.
Can you tell us what the estimated cost, the additional cost, is going to be now?
No, I can't. And it's not that I don't want to. It's just that I don't know right now. That's what the solution that we're going to pick is going to involve an increased amount of earthwork and moving dirt from one place to another. And in doing that, you have to do a couple of things. You have to figure out, do you have enough dirt in the places where you're going to take it from to move it to, and then how far are you going to have to move it, and how are you going to place it? And that is what's going on right now between us. Well, it's going on. We'll verify the contractor's calculations, but the contractor's estimating what those costs would be. So I don't know today what that additional cost.
Let us know when you find out.
I will.
Okay, go ahead.
So the other projects of statewide significance, I can't tell you a lot right now other than our staff is trying to break that down and trying to figure out what we can move forward on. In some cases, projects on this list, the corridor is, although we know where the corridor is, we don't know specifically where the road's going to go. In other cases, we're very close to having a final environmental document like a Newburgh-Dundee. So these are in a variety, and the I-5 Columbia River Crossing, I should add, and these are in a variety of different stages, and we'll have that full compilation for you in July. I can tell you on the Columbia River Crossing, just because we are working more closely with Washington, and we didn't really have to wait around for the analysis, that project's going to be ready to go to construction, we would anticipate, in the next two biennia. The EIS, provided the EIS gets completed.
Okay, question, Senator Johnson.
Just remind me, Mr. Tindall, how did these projects surface as projects of statewide significance? Not that I disagree, but I just want to know what process they went through.
Chairman Metzger, Senator Johnson, it was a number of years ago, and I don't know that I know the full process. I wasn't involved in every detail of the process, but the commission, in considering one of our STIP updates, was concerned. It was around the time that the acts were becoming more active, and I know that the commission was concerned that kind of what I portrayed on that on the second step, that maybe the projects would be overlooked somehow, and they were aware of some projects that they wanted to make sure, for a variety of reasons, were not overlooked, and so they adopted this list of projects. I don't believe that it was done in public, but I don't recall any public hearings around those list of projects. It was just adopted by the commission because they were known projects.
Senator George.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two quick questions on Project Statewide Significance. I'm getting a lot of feedback from folks in Salem about the limited access east-west in the Salem area. And how does a project like that get to the surface on statewide significance? That's my first question. I'll let you.
Chair Metzger, Senator George, lots of discussion about that project and a number of other projects, and I think we had this a conversation with the commission around this issue, and the commission's considering how you go about making sure that you have all of the projects on the list. Again, I go back to the Senate bill, this bill that we're discussing, the second point in this bill that we're discussing, and the strategy that we've employed to identify projects that could move forward in a STIP if there were additional money, but also to identify those very large projects. And I'm certain that the Salem Third Bridge is going to be on the Mid-Willamette Valley Area Commission of Transportation's list of projects over $100 million. Whether the commission eventually says, well, we need to recognize all of these and as large unfunded projects, or whether they augment these projects of statewide significance, I'm not sure how that plays out. But that this bill will help us get those kinds of projects that have come up since this original list was developed, or become more mature since this list was developed. That will help those projects come to the forefront.
One more quick question. Mr. Chair, the other thing is that I don't know if it's just the email lists I get on or such, but but I continue to get feedback about the I-5 Columbia River Crossing as far as when that was discussed, alternative bridge locations, and that particular project seems to have, for whatever political powers, very quickly gone into one choice, which is the replacement of the I-5 bridge, which may be appropriate. But it seems like there's a lot of controversy still lingering out there about the idea of a replacement bridge and basically adding capacity to a traffic corridor that basically you move the bottleneck a couple miles either way. And I just want to ask, based on how you've written this I-5 Columbia River Crossing, have we gotten down to the point where we can tell people who disagree with it that this is the project, that it's going to be a replacement bridge, or is it still at the stage where, you know, as we talked about the situation from Washington County coming over Cornelius Pass, that there's perhaps an alternative third bridge option that could cross the Columbia, or is that dead?
Chair Metzger, Senator George, nothing is ever dead. Let me just
somebody with a Tommy gun is after
you.
Must be your that email. So I don't think it's me. I think I'm off. But anyway, get the pace back. The where we are on the let me talk about this in a couple different phases. Where we are in the Columbia River Crossing, I think there are a number of people that would question whether or not we have quickly gotten down to a single option. It's been going on. The discussion's gone on for quite some time. It has been a very full discussion, a very public and transparent discussion. And it's playing itself out through the environmental impact process. What the last there's a task force meeting. This is probably deserving of some broader discussion. But there's a task force made up of a very very wide variety of people. And at the last task force meeting, there was general agreement around the table that we were likely headed for this project, for this Columbia River Crossing project, to a replacement bridge with high-capacity transit option of light rail. The draft EIS is not out for comment yet. It will be out shortly, and so we will. It's not done in the sense that we will continue to receive comment on that and through the final EIS. What's important, though, about the question about a third crossing or a different crossing, the analysis as I read it indicated that the third crossing, a crossing downstream, didn't solve the congestion and safety problems on the existing bridge. That doesn't mean that third crossing isn't needed. And so while it may not be part of this project, of the Columbia River Crossing project, it's not dead in the sense that the Portland area is going to continue to grow and the need is still there for those types of solutions that take us out of the what is currently the I-5 corridor. So I know that's a long and convoluted answer. As long as we're in the EIS, nothing is off the table. And even after the EIS is complete for the Columbia River crossing, other projects to get across the Columbia River have to remain in consideration as the region grows, in my opinion.
Quick follow-up, Mr.
Yeah.
Thank you. I guess the concerns that are very much raised when people are sending me quite a few emails on this issue, and I'm just trying to figure out what the politics are, but it seems like it's very much driven by light rail, which may be a very nice way, but if we're talking about a situation where we're going to spend $6 billion, what I'm mostly worried about is freight, and I'm mostly worried about whether or not we can move trucks across an important thoroughfare. And I really, with all due respect to those people who are rail advocates, this crossing across the Columbia and any other choices needs to really focus on the fact that are we going to move how 97% of the goods and services are moved, and that's over that tight little way. And the thing I think that I keep getting back, and it seems like it is somewhat credible, is that at least some people view, and it may just be a few people or maybe a larger segment, is that the folks that are making these decisions are focused on a few basic outcomes, which is a crossing with rail. And now that it's kind of come down to that, it looks like maybe perhaps the outcome was predetermined. And I just want to make sure that whatever that process is, because we've got to have a good representation to the federal government, whatever that representation is, it shouldn't be driven with an outcome-based decision-making process. We should have a decision-making process that appears to be objective. And when people make the statement that this is going to be the outcome and it's predetermined and then that is the outcome, it's kind of a little bit too coincidental, if you understand what I'm saying. And I just throw that out to you.
Chair Metzger, Senator George, I'll just we've been incredibly transparent, and we can walk you through literally volumes of documentation where we looked at every single option, and we have the numbers on every single option. And it does address the freight problem.
One thing I wanted to, Doug, I'll just interrupt you for a second.
Sorry.
Colleagues, on Tuesday we're going to have a presentation from those folks who are engaged in the Columbia River Crossing. So we'll be able to zoom in on that with those folks from the task force, et cetera, on Tuesday.
Mr. Chair, I guess I can say is that what's going to happen is with this particular project, I know we've got help from Washington and help from ourselves, and then hopefully a lot of federal help in on this project, and that's great. So we are talking about a project that's $5 to $7 billion.
With a B.
Yes. Yeah. And I just, what my concern is that if we have some people who are trying to spend a lot of money because they want a specific outcome, which is rail, I just don't want that to cloud this process and clearly look like, you know, that's what drove us to make a decision, that people are going to say, you just spent $6 billion to replace a bridge that moves the bottleneck roughly a mile and a half down the road. Because that's what appears to me when I drive through that region that we end up with. And I want to make sure that we as the oversight committee at least make sure we put that on the table. And I'll obviously be asking those questions. It's just the way it was listed on your sheet. I kind of want to make sure that we constantly have these things open for discussion.
Absolutely. Chair Metzger, Senator George, I have some great news for you. The current estimate for the bridge is a little bit less than $4 billion. So I just saved you $2 billion. And if you'd like to give me 1% of that, I'll take it for...
I think he knows where he'd like to spend it.
Yeah, I do. Actually, but I bet you that the estimate you gave me today is $4 billion, but I bet when we finish, it's closer to $8
billion. Yeah, we can... Chair Metzger, Senator George, when we have the discussion, we will talk about the inflation impacts. I can tell you in terms of the estimate, by comparison, there's a very rigorous process that considers risk. And when I talk about a number about $4 billion, there are a range of percentage chances of being less than or greater than certain amounts. And so when we talk about that number, we're in a range where we have good confidence. The inflationary pressures are a very real difficulty. As I'm sure you're aware, when you have projects identified in the 1980s and it costs $50,000 or $50 million, and a couple of decades of inflation go by, particularly at the rates of construction inflation that we've seen in the past, and now you're talking about a whole bunch more money. And so your fear is not unfounded. I can just tell you what the current estimate is, and we'll talk about those inflationary pressures as we move forward.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay. Well, thank you all. I'm going to let you get out. Oh,
one more.
I guess I won't let you out because you want to stay. Senator Johnson.
It contemplated within the Columbia River crossing, does it fix that bottleneck at PIR? Is that part of this project? Because I can't see building a $4 billion bridge that speeds traffic up enormously across the Columbia, and it comes right into that bottleneck at PIR, and we got the same bad problem.
Chairman Metzger, Senator Johnson, I believe that particular problem you're talking about is at Delta Park. And
it is Delta Park.
And that project is already under contract. In preparation for this bridge project, Washington undertook, and I cannot remember the name of the interchange in Washington, but they undertook some capacity improvements at the north edge of their portion of the project. We are doing Delta Park separate from this project and moving it forward as part of the commitment. So, yes, we're trying to take care of that problem.
Good.
As well.
Thank you.
Okay. Tuesday, colleagues, we will hear from folks on rural schools and also on the Columbia Crossing. And as we march down to Sinai, I think most of our work has been done, necessary work has been done, but we'll try and inform ourselves until the powers that be decide we can wrap up in Sinai. Okay? Thank you for your attendance. Have a good weekend. We're adjourned.
And that's good. Robin and I have already...